Hello, my friends. My goodness, can you believe how steadily we are moving to the end of the year? It's that time of year where we can feel pulled by the forces of family, season, and consumerism. I want you to remember to come back to you. Check in with yourself throughout the season with a pause, a breath, a word of self-compassion, a word of kindness. And there are a couple of special things I have planned to support you. First of all, for all my yoga teachers out there, I am leading a trauma-informed yoga teacher training this January 24th and 25th. It is so easy to traumatize or re-traumatize a practitioner in yoga spaces. In this training, you'll discover what it means to recognize and support trauma survivors in yoga studios and to bring yoga teaching off the mat. The info is on my website, laraland.us, under consulting, and of course, we'll have it in the show notes. And second, but certainly not least, I am doing very, very special episode on this podcast on December 22nd. I will be leading an alignment and manifestation workshop based on my life purpose journal and year-long coaching program, My Bliss Book. So purchase your copy of My Bliss Book in advance so you can do all the meditations and visualizations along with me, get past your blocks, out of your way, and start manifesting the life of your dreams in 2026. And that is also linked in the show notes and available on my website. I am so excited to bring this offering to you and to see what you cook up for the new year. Hi, I'm Lara Land, an integrative clinical mental health counselor, author of My Bliss Book and The Essential Guide to Trauma-Sensitive Yoga, and trauma sensitivity consultant. And this is the Beyond Trauma podcast. Here we explore healing, growth, and what it means to truly thrive. You'll hear from therapists of different approaches, wellness coaches, and people with lived experience who talk about how to build resilience and connection, shift habitual responses, and live in your values. Your time is valuable to me. My goal is for you to walk away from each episode with an insight or practice you can put into action to build more ease and clarity in your life. Here we go. Beyond Trauma listeners, did you know you can always start over? Giving myself permission to begin again at any moment has allowed me to constantly evolve, and it's a tool I use with all of my coaching clients. It's also the premise of my first book, My Bliss Book. My Bliss Book is an undated life purpose planner that comes with an automated coaching program sent directly to your inbox bi-weekly when you enroll using the secret URL found inside the book. You will receive my creative visualization meditation, encouraging you to move beyond social programming and self-imposed limitations and into visualizing your truest, most honest vision for your own unique life. Then using my Bliss Book, you will work backwards to develop actionable steps to meet goals throughout the year that take you towards your big vision. Have a habit of buying pretty planners and putting them down before they're finished? Not a problem. My bi-weekly emails provide just the nudge needed to pick up your planner again. And if you miss a few days, you don't waste your book. The book is undated, so you can always start again. My Bliss Book is available off my site, laraland.us, and is now 20% off for my podcast listeners with code STARTAGAIN. But hurry, this discount won't run forever. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Beyond Trauma. Hopefully you are a subscriber. Please subscribe. Please write us that review and share this episode. This is an important episode. We are talking about money and financial trauma. Why are we talking about money on Beyond Trauma? Well, money isn't just about dollars and cents. It carries history, identity, and emotion. And in this conversation, we are exploring the hidden ways that financial trauma shapes our behaviors, our relationships, and our sense of freedom, how trauma can be passed down through families and through systems, and why it shows up so strongly in our daily choices. We talk about how to navigate money conflicts in relationship, the psychology of scarcity and overspending, how to regulate our nervous systems when financial stress hits, practical steps for getting out of this money for time binary, And most importantly, we uncover how healing your relationship with money can open the door to freedom, not just financial, but emotional and relational too. So if you've ever struggled with money shame, scarcity fears, or relationship stress tied to finances, this episode is for you. I have on expert Rakim Sabri, financial therapist, author, and speaker specializing in helping individuals and organizations overcome financial trauma. He combines lived experience, clinical insight, and cultural critique to create transformative conversations around money, mental health, and empowerment. He's, friends, just fabulous. His forthcoming book, Overcoming Financial Trauma, expands his mission to redefine financial wellness through a trauma-informed and trauma-responsive lens. What a great and informative guest. You're gonna want your notebooks out. You're gonna want to take some notes for this one. Here we go. Rakim Sabri, thank you so much for making the time to be here. I really appreciate it.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you for sharing your platform with me.
You know, we talk a lot about trauma recovery here. We talk a lot about stressors and how people behave under stress and how they recover from that. And we've never done a money on episode on money, but money is a stressor, and it's something that we all have to deal with, and it affects all parts of our lives.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think it's relevant when we're talking about trauma to talk about money, and you specifically talk about financial trauma. I thought we would start with the basics of, you know, what that is.
Sure. So financial trauma is any instance observed or experienced that has a negative impact on the way someone views, interacts with, or believes about money. So this is a definition that I've used. There are other definitions out there, but the areas of focus that I like to place on that definition is that piece about experienced or observed, right? Because most of the time when we talk about financial trauma, we're talking about like that first person experience, and not what is the experiences that we observe as a part of our financial socialization, our ongoing financial socialization that starts in childhood. And so in talking about financial trauma through that lens, we get into, I mean, so many rabbit holes, right? There's a lot of cultural commentary that can be had. There's a critique of capitalism, this dominant economic system that we navigate. There is the dysregulation of our nervous system that is, I believe, in part by design, right? When we look at some of the best practices in advertising and PR. And so there's so many variables and levers that are being pulled that influence our relationship with money, how we view money, what money represents to us, and ultimately what our behaviors look like when it comes to navigating money.
It's so deep. It's so deep. And it's like, when we talk about like generational trauma or cultural trauma, you know, those are the things that we're swimming in where we might not even notice that our behaviors are being affected every day by all this stuff unless we take the time or something forces us to step out of it and look at it and realize we don't have to be behaving this way. It's just the only way we've ever known.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah. Do you want to dive deeper into some of those systems and some of those, what we might have experienced as a child that might be showing up in our behaviors today?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you kicked it off great when you made reference to the generational piece. So I talk about financial trauma through six lenses, and one of those is genetic and generational. So on the generational side, that speaks to some of the attitudes and beliefs that we pass down culturally. So things that we say, things that, you know, we're told, things that we heard starting in childhood, but also speaks to some of the biological processes, right, that occur through this rise in epigenetic studies. And so when we look at the impact of stress or poverty or exclusion on how our body responds in our lived experience, but also in the future generations, we are dealing with trauma from our parents, our grandparents, our great grandparents. And to your point, we may not even know that this exists. We may not even be able to acknowledge it because A, there's often not language placed in describing that this occurrence is a real occurrence. And then B, and like I said, you said it beautifully, it's the only way sometimes that we know how. And so that's one source. The next is vicarious or observational. And so that I spent a little bit of time just now talking about that, but that's our financial socialization. And there are some studies out there that speak to the forming of beliefs around money, really kind of actualizing at the age of 7. So when we think about what are we doing at the age of 7? What are we hearing? What are we observing? How does that influence our future behavior with money? This is well before income earning years. When we get into an income earning position, how do the experiences, observations, the beliefs, the narratives, all those things show up in how we spend money, what jobs we even pursue, right? How we spend money, how we save, if we save, what this practice of investing looks like, and what our reactions to the different environmental stimuli look like, whether that is calming down in an overactive nervous system, whether that is addressing stress that may be financial or may not be financial, whether that is seeking control or power over circumstances, right? And so we use money to kind of address a lot of these things. And I think the most popular example that people tend to relate to is the idea of retail therapy, right? Like, I deserve this thing.
Right.
And so we go out and we go and we take the money that we have traded our time for to buy the thing that we feel like we deserve. So we get that dopamine hit, and then it's like another thing. And so that vicarious and observational piece is, I think, the foundation for how that is later shaped when it comes to our behaviors with money. The third source that I talk about is financial hardship through poverty or financial instability. And so, of course, that has a profound impact on our relationship with money and ultimately what financial trauma looks like, because often in that state, you are acting through a lens of survival, right? And so you are making the decisions that are, in your mind, the best decisions for you in that moment. And what's difficult about that is many financial educators will talk through a lens that does not take into account what's happening on a neurological, psychological, biological level when we seek safety. And I'm pointing the finger at myself, right? As a financial professional, this was me once upon a time, where the idea was, well, if you know better, you'll do better. And so we dump more strategy, more information, more knowledge on how to navigate financial systems and processes and services and et cetera, and not take into account that maybe the individual needs that. And they also may know that, but may not be able to make a different decision because they're operating in this survival state. The fourth source I talk about is workplace and employment. So this concept of fawning as a trauma response shows up when we go to work sometimes because we have to do what we have to do in order to get the paycheck, right? So we may exhibit traits or hide parts of ourselves, code switch, engage in these people-pleasing behaviors because we want the raise, we want the promotion, or we simply just want to maintain our employment. And, you know, I have some cultural commentary that I'll make separately on that note, but I'm seeing a lot in social media right now around people losing their jobs for exercising freedom of speech. And, you know, of course, individuals are working at at-will organizations, and so that at-will kind of goes both ways. But, you know, people have to be mindful of the fact that what they do, what they say, what they believe, how they show up can ultimately impact their employment. I think people are conscious of that, and that's where that fawning behavior takes place. On the other side of that, there are instances, and it's unfortunate but true, where we have to look at the wealth gap and the wage gap when it comes to women, when it comes to minorities, when it comes to certain industries, and how there are abuses that take place around the withholding of wages or not being paid fairly for the work that you do, or expectations around how you show up from an energetic perspective or a capacity perspective in the workplace. And what does that translate to in terms of your own safety by way of the paycheck, right? So I think that that's a often overlooked source of financial trauma, because you would not associate the place where you're making the money to be a stressor, but certainly exists as one. The next is institutional or systemic. So, you know, I talk about the institutional or systemic variables that exist within really everything that we touch, right? Healthcare, education, law, the workplace, you know, when you go out to go buy a house, the financial systems, all of these different systems, when we kind of pull back the layers and look at who were these systems designed to benefit and who were these systems designed to oppress? And how does that continue to show up even when we have laws and regulations and initiatives that say that they prioritize equality or equity for everyone? The foundation of a lot of these institutions still prioritize a particular subset of the the public demographic. And so that contributes to trauma, right? And there is documented present day and historical instances of systemic harm being caused against all people. And then lastly, I talk about family, societal, and religious as one category. And so those are the expectations that surface as you navigate life, right? You know, people are putting a tremendous amount of pressure on themselves to buy a house by a certain age, get married by a certain age, have kids by a certain age. There are a lot of cultural norms that are kind of perpetuated in cycles that may not exist in alignment with your personal value system, that may not exist in alignment with what your personal financial reality is. And unfortunately, because this is the way things have been done, people are opting into these cultural cycles, and it is creating an additional layer of stress, financial harm, right? And also, I want to speak specifically to individuals who are first generation high income earners or graduates or what have you, because they're at a kind of fork in the road, right, where they can continue to operate in status quo or they can make a change. And making that change is often very difficult and sometimes painful. So this is why I include that as a layer in the overall sources of financial trauma.
Wow. I mean, I think it's helpful to have the categories. And also, like, wow, there's a lot of ways that we're being impacted by systems. And, you know, when you said that about 7 years old, I know that from my studies as well, that's around that age that we are able to kind of understand, based on our identities, like what jobs are even like what we think might be quote unquote reasonable for us, you know, like we're already like setting ceilings for ourselves and making judgments about that at that young of an age. Sometimes we have opportunities that help to break us out of those ideas, and sometimes not. And like you said, if you're that first person in the family, that comes with a whole other set of, you know, what do you owe back to the family? What do you owe back to the community? Do you break with norms? Do you use that independence to create something new? I mean, there's just so many questions this opens up. I guess I'm wondering, where could a person start to kind of look at those six factors, and is there kind of a self-evaluation one could do to kind of see which are impacting them the most, and how are those showing up in their behaviors?
I love this question, because my first answer is no, right? There's nothing standard that people can do. But in some of the workshops that I've done, I've done an exercise that looks at your lifespan development. So there's a map where it's like infant all the way up through present day. And at each different stage, we're also looking at the six sources of financial trauma. What I ask the audience to do is to identify at the different stages of their life where one of the sources may have been more prominent or may just have showed up, right? Because at 7, let's say, you may not be conscious of the impact of systemic harm being done because you're not out in the world, right? And so that's not going to be something that surfaces for you. However, at 7, you may be conscious of financial hardship and poverty if that is the reality for your family. And what I think makes this exercise more, I think, four-dimensional is that how you react to this source of trauma, let's say financial hardship and poverty at 7, is going to look different than how you react to this source of financial trauma at 27 or 37 or 57, right? Because where you may be kind of like going along for the ride as a passenger at one stage, now you're in a position of control. You're in a position of, you know, maybe I can do something about this. So usually when I do that activity, there's a lot of reflection that takes place, and I do that activity with a group. So individuals are not only taking inventory of their own experiences across the lifespan, but they're hearing from their peers how those experiences may be similar or may look different across their lifespan. And so we can see where there's overlap or where there's more prominence of one than another. And I think that that's very helpful in, first of all, driving home this idea of these different sources of trauma, but also in understanding that you don't have to just pick one, right? Like these sources can be present simultaneously across your lifespan. So you might have 2 and 6 at one point and 1 and 3 at another point, or you might have 1 through 6, you know, consistently through a period of time. And your bandwidth or ability to address these different sources of trauma may also look different, right? Your bandwidth or ability to address poverty or financial hardship may look different than your bandwidth or ability to address what it is that you observe about money and trauma. I think that's the closest thing. And yeah, I've been kind of scanning the financial circles anyway around financial trauma and what tools are present. Haven't seen any. Working on creating one presently, but there could be something out there that I'm not aware of.
Yeah, I mean, I think you coming up with your own system is beautiful, because you're taking in your own experience and how you've learned about it and creating different systems. I know years ago I worked with the chakra system with money, and I found that really powerful, because like the root is the survival, then you have like the emotions, you have your power, which you brought up a little, I want to talk about more, so how we're putting our will into it, our voice and so forth. So there's a lot of different frameworks we can use to kind of analyze how this is affecting our nervous system and our behaviors. I'm imagining people react in different ways to their financial trauma. I mean, from what I've seen and experienced in my life, you know, we can have a lot of fear around money. We can save every penny, be very tight, be afraid to spend. I've noticed sometimes I'll get really constricted in my life. And then like you talked about, like this, oh, I deserve, you know, just, and it feels good to let go a little bit. Something about spending frivolously can sometimes just feel relaxing or something. There's impulse buying, where we feel like if we have this thing, we'll feel better, which many of us, if we sit with that a while, realize that after a short period of time, that thing no longer gives that feeling. I mean, we have that kind of stereotypical thing of like, you know, a guy buying a flashy car to show status. So I don't know, maybe you can speak to some of those behavioral patterns and how they are soothing something inside of us, and how can we break those, and how.
I'm having a lot of thoughts right now. The first thought that I had as you were speaking was understanding the primary function of our brain, right? And that is to identify and establish safety for us, right? So when we are making these decisions and we view those decisions through the lens of seeking safety, I think that it explains a lot of the behavior. Explains, not excuses, right? But explains a lot of the behavior, because safety looks and is represented differently across, you know, the different individuals who are navigating, right? It looks different for everybody. And when you layer on top of that social class, right? When you layer on top of that race, I think that's an important variable to include. When you layer on top of that your identity as a man, woman, or other, right? Whatever intersectionality is present, those variables are going to show up in how you are able to identify and accomplish or achieve safety, right? The second train of thought that I had as you were speaking, especially as it relates to the behaviors, is that there's so much blame, shame, guilt, and finger pointing when it comes to the way that people use their money that ignores, like completely ignores, the variable of influence that nudges us in that direction, right? So I talk a lot about, and you know, I have to give credit where credit is due, Chantel Chapman, who's the founder of Trauma of Money, has a program called The Trauma of Money that I was a participant in. And throughout her program, she introduces Edward Bernays, who is the nephew of Freud and known as the father of advertising and PR. And Edward Bernays was able to change the industry of advertising by teaching advertisers how to connect individuals' emotions to the advertisements, right? So we're not selling, or we're not being sold to from a rational perspective. We're being sold to based off of our emotions. And as someone who is an entrepreneur who has to know marketing, there is always the conversation around, you know, who is your client avatar? What do they like? You know, what's their age range? What do they read? Where do they go, right? Like, this is a part of the way that we are taught to market to people. And contextualizing that, we have to realize too, with our smartphones, with our social media, with our online, we are constantly being bombarded with advertisements that tell us you will be safe if whatever, right? And so our safety is translated through a lens of how attractive we appear, how smart we appear, what kind of jobs we can get, what kind of clothes we can wear, what are we signaling by the brands that we put on our bodies? And when we go back to that conversation around our financial socialization, starting very young, we learn to identify individuals and groups of the haves and the have-nots from grade school, right? We are able to identify very quickly, based off of the way that they are treated, the groups of the haves and the have-nots. And subconsciously, I believe that we continue to add to that exposure in saying, I do not want to be a part of the have-nots because I don't want to be treated that way, right? We are recognizing that that is an unsafe pathway. And so the safe route is to demonstrate that we do have, even if we don't have. That can look like excessive consumption. That can look like I'm going to buy not only so that I can feel better in this moment, but so that I can show to other people that I am doing better than I actually am. So when we look at some of these behaviors, like those that you mentioned, right? The guy buying the new car or anything, right? Anything that we are spending our money on. A lot of times we're looking to buy not the cheapest thing or even the most functional thing, but the thing that is recognized, the thing that has the most 5-star reviews, the thing that is the most popular. And that is the variable that we use to make our purchasing decision many times. I'll share a personal story briefly. Over the weekend, I went to a football game with my dad and I didn't eat before. So I had to drive 2 hours to get to my dad, and then we had to drive 2 hours to get to the game. So no food was eaten that morning. I was extremely hungry, and I knew that if I had to eat before I got to the stadium, that I would likely buy the food at the stadium. Got to the stadium with no food, and so I'm hungry. I go, I buy the food. It's overpriced, right? And I'm sitting there, and I'm eating this food, and I know that this food is not good. Like, I do not enjoy this food, but I'm enjoying it because I'm hungry. And in the process of recognizing that I'm hungry and I'm enjoying it because I need the food, I'm also acknowledging how the stadium has massively inflated what the cost of these items would look like. And in any other environment and instance, I would never pay what I paid for that stadium food. And so I'm sharing that because I think that the environment matters, right? The environment in this instance being the stadium, but for anybody else on any given day can be whatever, right? The means matter, right? I had the means to buy the overpriced food. And so, yeah, I could kick myself about it later, but I had it. If I didn't have it, then I would have just been hungry at the stadium. And so the means matters in these instances. And then also what we are satisfying also matters, right? So in that instance, I'm satisfying my hunger. But, you know, hunger can be replaced with so many other needs or emotions that human individuals are experiencing. So the common denominator across all of this is the money, right? Like, you have to have the money, or if you don't have the money, then you don't, at least you're interpreting it as I can't get what it is that I need.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the other way is, right, there's people who have so much money and it's still not enough. So, you know, I always think, you know, I've been through ups and downs in my life and I'm still going through ups and downs. And I always think, like, the thing I can control is not wanting as much. If I don't need one every, you know, if I can tell me, you know, be happy with what I have, then there's less of that drive to have more.
Yeah, that's an important point. And I believe that it is an uphill battle to make yourself not want something.
It is.
Right?
It is.
Because you're constantly being told or programmed to want something.
Yeah.
And so from a financial perspective, when we get into conversations around denial, I think that's a great word, denial. I like to talk about what financial boundaries look like, not only with other people and telling other people no, but in how you tell yourself no. And so that is a conversation that involves taking an audit of what your values are and whether or not these goals that you have for yourself are consistent with those values. Because you might tell yourself no to something that you truly do value, and then your value is going to override that no every time, and then you're going to feel bad about it. But if you are telling yourself no that to something that is in alignment with your values, say, hey, no, I don't want to do this because I value this, it's easier for you to stick by that no because it's consistent with something that is a value to you.
And I love that. I love that. I always encourage my clients to do value assessments. And I think that works with so many things. Like, so otherwise we're just making choices without any, like, you know, guidelines. And just priorities work into that too. I'm thinking about, like, time, and because you said this before, you know, when we spend money on something, then there's like a time equivalent. Like, I have to work some more hours to make money to buy those other things. I think about that stuff a lot. Like, this is going to be 3 hours away from my daughter because I'm going to need to work. So is it worth it to have this thing, or is it worth it to have those 3 hours back with her?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And it goes back to a point that you had made earlier. Many times people are socialized to view the accumulation of money through a lens of exchanging their time. And you do not necessarily need to engage in trading your time for money in order to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think more people are starting to wake up to the idea that they can make money in their sleep, right? And it's been marketed and sensationalized as passive income. And then the debate comes into question, well, is there such thing as passive income, right? But I do believe that you can get to a place where you can create product, service, system that allows for you to make money without having to trade your time for it. And that allows for you to be intentional about how you use your time in being able to either create a stream of income or multiply.
Yeah. For folks who want to start moving in that direction, any basic guidelines? I mean, I imagine there's a few different ways that one could go with investment, real estate, creating a course or a product that makes money.
Yeah, I think those three are, I think, the traditional responses, right? Investing looks different for everybody. So it doesn't necessarily just have to be the stock market or it has to be real estate. But investing is a way for you to put money that you earn from trading your time into something that does not require you to be present and growing what that looks like over time. I think info products are great. Info products and services are great. So when you talk about creating a course, that does not necessarily have to look like sitting behind a camera and, okay, we're going to talk about these things. You can make money through your knowledge through a variety of ways, writing, books, blogs, newsletters, and monetizing that. You can do exchanges of knowledge with other people. And so I think when we look at and I'm having a bunch of thoughts right now. When we look at money in the traditional sense of how money is used, really money is used to facilitate an exchange, right, of currency. And so how we define currency has largely landed on the exchange of like the paper dollar in the United States anyway. But there are practices that predate the exchange and are still present today, but predate the exchange of the dollar that I think we've gotten away from, right? So when we talk about building community and we talk about maybe bartering services, like that's a way for you to give of something that you have in exchange for something that somebody else has. And so you're not necessarily going and you know, punching a clock and being a cog in the machine. Yes, you're spending time to create some kind of value, but you're creating some kind of value that you can exchange with somebody else at no or low cost. But we live in a capitalist society and system. And so I don't want to offer solutions that are not realistic for most people in terms of long-term sustainability. So when we talk about bartering, yes, I think it's important for us to be able to have some specialized knowledge, or it doesn't even have to be specialized, but some knowledge that somebody else doesn't have, and being able to exchange that, whether that looks like exchange for money as we know it, or resources as an alternative form of payment. And that involves finding somebody who's going to be on the same page as you there. And then you talked about real estate. That's a touchy topic because it's really hard, depending on what market you live in, for individuals to buy homes, but it's not impossible. And so maybe, you know, if somebody's really passionate about owning real estate, maybe that looks like exploring a different geographic area than they have kind of settled in. And they could be distant owners as well of land or of homes. But I don't want to have a friend of mine who's really like anti-capitalist, and I'm not quite on the anti-capitalist wave, but I recognize the harm that capitalism causes. And so I don't want to offer only solutions that are in alignment with profit. But I do understand that there's a necessity there for individuals who are looking for different ways. And so I want to offer multiple paths in my articulation of this. Well, I'm not saying prioritize the profit by going out and buying all of these houses and playing Monopoly with, you know, people's lives. But I am saying that I believe that ownership is important. And so whatever that looks like, if you're owning your brand, if you're owning content that you create, if you're owning stock, if you're owning gold and silver, people are talking about Bitcoin, if you're owning a home, all of those things contribute. But I would not do this from a lens of desperation. I think this is the part that I want to underscore, to do this from a lens of information, like understand what it is that you're putting your money into. And if you want additional help finding somebody who is qualified to give you the education on what being involved with that asset class looks like.
For those of us who are interested in starting, like dipping our toe in investment, are there any resources you would recommend? Because that seems like sometimes kind of this mysterious world that a lot of people are locked out of, that, you know, afraid. I mean, we hear about people losing everything that they invested. Any thoughts on that and recommendations?
I don't offer financial advice because I'm not licensed to do so. So in terms of telling people exactly what they can invest in, that's a no-go for me. But I can point people to FINRA.org, I believe. And FINRA has a list of credentialed professionals that and an explanation of what they do. Right. So when somebody approaches you with an investment opportunity and you want to ensure that they are credentialed and licensed to be able to do that thing, you can go to FINRA.org and compare what credentials they have or they don't have, right, to this list that's present. But generally, you're going to find individuals that offer investment advice have a license. So I think it's the series 7 and series 66, or series 7 and series 65 and 66, that allows for individuals to be able to give you investment advice. But you don't need to work with an advisor necessarily to get started with investing. You just need to understand what is the house that the investments can live in. So that is a traditional brokerage, IRA, whether that be a traditional or a Roth. That can be a HSA, which is a health savings account. That can be, that those are your traditional investment, like houses, if you will. For cryptocurrencies, that is kind of a newer asset class. And so people are investing in crypto wallets. I don't have enough education to make advice on that, so I won't. But generally, what you would see is somebody would open up a crypto wallet on a platform like a Coinbase, or there are others out there. They would put their, they'll link it to their bank account, and they will put their money in there electronically, and then they would start investing in the cryptocurrencies through that platform. Real estate investing is you're taking actual dollars and you're going out and you're buying titles to property. Or you're going to the bank and you're getting a mortgage or some kind of line of credit to be able to cover the cost of acquiring a property. But there is a way to invest in real estate through the stock market. So they're called REITs. I think it's a real estate exchange trust. But there's so many options out there for people to get started. I just think it's important to understand, like, foundationally, what is your goal? Is it medium, long-term goal? Is it retirement? Is it planning for your children's education? And then you can kind of back your way or reverse engineer your way into the right house for your products, and then what it is that you want to invest in inside of that house for your product.
Excellent. I love that. Like, again, that's that goal in mind and working backward from there. And that's like one of my major principles. I'm curious, I have two kind of questions around this. I guess one is, how do you think about like enjoying your life now and what money can bring for the now, and that balance with saving for later or saving for future generations? How do you coach people with that balance and how they see that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an echo or reiteration of kind of the themes that we've been talking about here, right? So we're going to place their values at the forefront of that conversation. I always tell people, like, I don't tell people what to do. I educate them on what they can do. And so that looks different for everybody. From a financial therapy lens, though, some people will operate in extremes of vigilance when it comes to their money that is disguised as positive money habits.
Yeah.
With saving, investing, and planning for the future. So in those instances where they're operating through extremes, so they're taking 80, 90% of their income and they're putting it away because they don't feel safe. That's where a conversation around, okay, let us like really break down what is the motivation behind the behavior and not so much what is the behavior itself. Because on paper, that looks great because you're putting away so much money, but are you putting pressure on yourself in such a way that you're not able to enjoy your money now or in the near future? And on the other side of that, you have people who have this very relaxed approach to their finances where they're not worried about the future at all. They're not thinking about it. And that can also be reflective of some financial trauma because the individual is engaged in active avoidance, right? Like, this is something that is going to happen. Like, you are going to get to a point where you're going to need this money and you're not preparing for that. What is the reason why? What is the need that you are fulfilling in this moment? And that's not the, I'm not saying that is the case blanketly, right? Because there are some people who do live very much in a paycheck to paycheck cycle and they cannot afford to put money away, additional money away. And so that is going to require a different approach. But I think understanding, for me as the practitioner, understanding what is their current circumstance, what is their goal, and then what is the behavior that either is in alignment with that goal or that is taking away from that goal? And, you know, we color that with their values, right? Because it's not for me to say, hey, you need to be saving more money. It's for me to ask them, you know, what is important to you about your future that will, that may require you to save more money, right? If you tell me that this is something that you want to accomplish and I'm looking at your budget and you're not working towards that goal, then I have to ask some hard questions.
Yes. Yes. Beautiful.
But I do believe, I know that, you know, that was a longer answer, but I do believe that we should be enjoying our money. And certainly there are ways to do that in moderation, but we're not here to just work, get paid, put the money away and never enjoy it. I think there has to be, you know, like when we look at it through a fitness lens, when people have like their cheat meals or their rest days, like there has mm-hmm. to be little moments where we're able to allow ourselves to enjoy our money.
I agree. I'm curious if you have any advice for folks who are in relationships where the two people have a different perception on saving versus spending, or different risk tolerance for investment and so forth.
Yeah, this is a common question I get. And I think this is a common occurrence that financial therapists broadly approach, because, I mean, it's complicated enough navigating your relationship with money based off of all the variables that we've talked about today, right? But when you combine all of those variables with those same variables that exist in a completely different human with a completely different set of experiences and expectations and influences, it can create a clash. But it's not an impossible clash. And so many financial therapists who work with couples will do, you know, very similar to what we've discussed, kind of a value audit. We may not be able to get people 100% on the same page, but we can get them closer to being on the same page than they were when they came to us. I think if I was going to give some very broad, generic advice, it would be certainly play to your strengths and to be conscious of your compliments. Right. So if one of the partners is really good at saving and one of the partners is really bad at saving, like they are an excessive spender, then of course a conversation needs to be had around where are we steering this ship? Are we steering it in two completely different directions? Because if so, we'll never get there. But if you are having a hard time with saving, maybe I could take more of an active role in the saving part of this process. Right. And if you are somebody who enjoys spending, maybe I can take a more active role in helping to create value-based spending patterns where we get to do the things that we enjoy, but they are in alignment with something that we've decided to do together.
Yeah, I think it goes back to what you said about like the values and the vision. And it's really good when couples can come together and talk about, you know, where are we going? What are, you know, we started doing with our daughter who's just six, is like, what are our family values? And to have some kind of united vision, or else, of course, your actions are going to be all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also like to talk about this word culture. Because a lot of times when we hear the word culture, we associate it with language, ethnicity, religion, right? We don't think about the culture of our household, right? We don't think about the culture of our workplace. We don't think about regional culture. We don't think about religious culture. And so when we look at that, when we pull back the layers of that word culture, and, you know, to your point, discussing what are the family values, right? That is an offering of a creation of culture that everybody doesn't have to, but can choose to opt into. And as a result, if we can opt into it, we can opt out of it, and we can also create a new version of it, right? And so I think, you know, what you said was beautiful when it comes to the establishment of family values, that this is our family culture, right? We believe collectively in this thing. And if there's deviation from that, like, that's a conversation. But I think one of the drivers for success in addressing and healing financial trauma is to build community. And so what is going to keep that community cohesive is this idea of culture that we surface. And that doesn't have to be we're doing it this way because my parents did it this way and my grandparents did it this way. That could be, we're doing it this way because my parents didn't do it this way and I know where that lands. But I think in addition to just using your example as the example, in addition to surfacing what culture can look like through the lens of the parents, that children can also contribute to what the culture looks like, right? Like they can share their ideas and opinions about what's important to them and how that is in alignment or how that may be different than what the established norms are. And that everybody can kind of help to solidify or firm up what this vision of culture looks like so that it is inclusive.
Love that, bringing in the children's voices. I guess we did that, and it's nice to hear you affirming that. And I think what I heard a little bit in there too is like, and something we're doing is kind of like the check-in, like, have we been not just creating the vision, because, you know, we all know we can do that on January 1st every year, but like, you know, have we been living toward that, or have we strayed? And is there a reason we strayed? Are we happy that we went in a different direction, or do we want to realign? And so, you know, this isn't, I don't think, a one and done, but I think all these, you know, there's a part of me that always wants those final answers and how do we do it and how do we fix it? You know, I'm working on a lifetime of accepting that it's, you know, rinse, wash, repeat. And we're always checking in. We're modifying the things that you talked about today, the kind of impacts of society and family and generations and scarcity. I mean, these are going to keep coming up. It's not like we're going to just fix this and move on. Even when you said about doing things different than parents, what came up for me is how we can even take that in extreme. So I remember my mom cutting the coupons and going to the sales. And I have a resistance to a sale, you know, because I was turned off by that. I was embarrassed by it. So now like it's almost like hard for me to buy something on sale. Where, why not? I mean, if it's something that you already want, not buying it because it's on sale, buying something that you don't want, because then you're not really saving, you're spending. But if it's like, you know, so I have to watch that whole talk of the point of resisting the parents where it becomes like you're harming yourself.
Yeah, 100%. In those experiences, those early experiences, what it is that we've observed about our parents or how they've engaged in, you know, how they learn to engage with money, right? Because we learn as we get older, right, that everybody's figuring it out as they're going. And because as children, we don't have that vantage point, we just think that our parents know, right? Like we get older, we give them a little bit more grace because like, okay, like they were doing the best that they can. And in that, we can learn from their experiences and work with what works, right? So like when I heard you say that, I'm thinking, this is good news. And so I'll tell you why. The programming of advertising psychology around sales is going to have less of an impact on you because you're resistant to it, right? Mm-hmm. So you can use that to your advantage while also being conscious of the fact that there is an opportunity for you to decrease the cost of doing business when those sales are in alignment with something that you want and or need. So it kind of creates this opportunity for you to like have a superpower that most people don't have because they see sale and they're like, oh my God, I got to get it only because it's on sale.
Yeah. You save 100% of what you didn't buy.
That's a fact.
I really so value everything you bring to this conversation, Akim. You have a really, you're not this or that. You're bringing in so much. You're subtle. You're helping us to think about things in a complicated and subtle way, but that's real to life. I know you've spoken about that even folks in your same position, financial advisors and financial therapists, can work on our fears to benefit their own businesses. And I really appreciate your conscientiousness about not doing that. I mean, I can feel your nervous system just super calm and grounded. It's true, you know, and you're not giving us quick fixes. You're really speaking to me, and I know to the people that listen to this podcast. What did I miss? What are some important things before we wrap? I don't know if we want to talk a little bit about people that want to leave the 9-to-5, or I know you had a famous breakup with that people can look up if we don't want to get into that now. Important things that are on your mind right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we are in a very difficult moment in time, right, when it comes to the world economy, but specifically the U.S. economy. And in this difficult moment in time, I think that these messages resonate a lot louder, or will resonate a lot louder with people, because they're feeling the heat, they're feeling the pain. You made a point about this being an ongoing journey, right? Rinse, repeat. And I think, so throughout this year, I've been on a fitness journey, and fitness has always been part of my life. But long story short, last year, I did not participate in exercise at all. Like, I did not go to the gym. I had this aversion and I wanted to go, but for whatever reason, I had this mental block, and I was also eating terribly, right? So I was doing massive harm to my body. And so this year, January 1st, I say, I want to go to the gym, and I like want to make it a lifestyle. I want to be consistent. And I'm very proud to say that every week of the year this year, with maybe the exception to one, I've gone to the gym at least 3 times. And in the week that I did not go to the gym at least 3 times, I still went to the gym. I just didn't go 3 times, right? So like, I've been in the gym every week this year. And, you know, when we are on a fitness journey, it's the same as like our financial journey, right? Like, you can't get to the place of peak fitness perfection and be like, all right, cool, like, I'm here,
I did it,
I'm done, right? Like, you're going to have to keep doing it. And so this, the same is true, because the attacks, and I use this word very intentionally, the attacks on our nervous system don't stop, right? A dysregulated person is a profitable one. And so going to constantly receive messaging and nudges and, you know, the incorporation of fear and doubt and guilt and threats to our security through our news cycles, because that encourages people to spend money. And that is what keeps putting money in the top of the food chain, the pockets at the top of the food chain. We look at like the pandemic, and when, you know, people were hoarding toilet paper and hand sanitizer, right? Like, we took a moment that was very scary for a lot of people, and it turned into, you know, again, the have and the have nots. If you had the money to buy the things, you bought the things. And then, you know, we saw some people taking those things and then trying to resell them at like inflated prices, the have and the have not. So the example that I gave about, you know, this past weekend and going to the stadium, all of the examples that I've given, you know, it really, I think, hits this point home. And so my advice to anybody listening is, you know, we didn't talk too much about the nervous system or, you know, how to regulate and, you know, go into those practices. But I would encourage people to get educated on what are these triggers that cause us to react in many times, if not all times, opposition of how we actually want to react, because our bodies are responding before our mind has the ability to kind of catch up. Or our mind is responding because it believes that this is a threat and this is the best way forward for us to establish safety. So I'll pause there, because I think that was a lot. But common practices that I recommend, definitely the use of affirmations, definitely breath work. You talked about chakra work earlier. I have a colleague in financial therapy who uses Reiki in his practice. So he deals with clearing the energetic blockages across the chakras, breathing, box breathing, right? Like, I think that's like one of our greatest gifts, is we wake up in the morning and we can breathe. But intentional breathing is important. Rest is important. You do not need to earn your rest, right? And I think more people are starting to embrace this. But, you know, again, that workplace and corporate spaces tell you, like, if you're not being productive, you're not valuable. And so people have a hard time just sitting still and relaxing. That's very important. And lastly, you know, I have a book that's coming out in 2 months. November 12th is the release date, called Overcoming Financial Trauma. So very proud of this book. Pretty much everything that I've discussed today is covered in some way, shape, or form in this book, The Six Sources of Financial Trauma. some steps to financial healing, you know, incorporating community, incorporating Reiki, incorporating values, looking at the system, looking at how we teach financial education and being critical of that. Even looking at how financial therapy is designed and the approaches to some of those interventions is critiqued. So there's nobody who has been spared in all of this, not even myself. I critique myself in this book. So definitely recommend for individuals who are interested in understanding financial trauma better, who are interested in healing financial trauma within themselves, for their community, in their workplaces. And again, that book is called Overcoming Financial Trauma, and it's due to release November 12th, but it is available for pre-order anywhere you can buy books.
And I think this will be coming out right about then. So it might be November 12th right now, guys. I think this is going to be actually line up perfectly in the way that the universe can. So I think that's great. I'm very excited to personally get my hands on your book. I love your message and you have so much to teach us. And I love how you're bringing in the nervous system work and the breath work. I've noticed myself sigh and release a few times during this conversation with as things have hit home. Yeah. Thank you so much. Let people know where your website and your Instagram or any socials, and we'll send them there.
Yeah. So my website is my name. That's rakimsabri.com. And all of my socials are my name as well. So that's at rakimsabri. So anywhere that is worth being, I'm probably there. I also have a Forbes column, so forbes.com/sites/RakimSabri. I make some commentary on financial trauma broadly, or rather financial trauma, specifically financial wellness broadly. But lately I've been leaning into the topic of financial trauma. So definitely, you know, you can check me out either at that direction or just go to forbes.com and type my name into the search. And I hope that those are some valuable resources for your audience who are interested in learning more.
Absolutely, Rakim. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you.
As we buzz around the busy world, it becomes clear there are billions of paths. As we buzz around the busy world, we will appear in other people's photographs. As we speed through the centuries, we will collide and the light will bend. We will be accidentally immortalized in someone else's land.